Dear Lonely Writer, another week, another inspirational conversation with an author I cannot help but admire. Charlotte Gill is the author of Almost Brown, a mixed-race family memoir. In her memoir, Charlotte examines the brilliant messiness of ancestry, diversity, and the idea of quote-unquote race, a historical concept that still informs our beliefs about ethnicity today. Charlotte herself was born in London and raised in the United States and Canada. She is also the author of Eating Dirt, a national bestseller that won the BC National Award for Canadian Nonfiction. This title was a finalist for the Hilary Weston Writers' Trust Prize and the RBC Taylor Prize. Her previous book, Lady Killer, was a Governor General's Award nominee. Her fiction and narrative nonfiction have appeared in Vogue, The Guardian, Oprah Daily, Lit Hub, The Walrus, and many other newspapers and magazines. Charlotte is the Rogers Communication Chair in Literary Journalism at the Banff Center, as well as faculty in the MFA program in Creative Nonfiction at the University of King's College. She lives on the Sunshine Coast of British Columbia, Canada. Today, we talked about the importance of having a community of writers around you, whether it be through forced proximity or outright search and discover. We also discussed identity and discovery and how to keep those creative muscles warmed up. Thank you for joining us again. And Lonely Writer, enjoy the show.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me today, Charlotte. I just want to jump in to talking about the who of it, you know, before we start recording. As I said, as a memoirist myself, I'm always like, I just love hearing why people write their stories, especially a memoir. But let's go back a little further and, you know, what started it for you? What kind of got the ball rolling on you thinking that, you know, or wanting to be an author, that this was like a real thing adults get to do as it's their lifelong, you know, careers and dreams? What started that for you?
I actually remember the exact moment because, and that's saying something because yeah. I am no spring chicken anymore. I was in an undergrad English class at the University of Toronto, and the instructor was telling a story about how he'd gotten to work that day. And he said he'd been driving along down Bloor Street and got stuck behind this garbage truck. And he was watching this back in the day when there were city employees who manually went to go pick up the cans and the garbage bags and toss them into the hopper in the back. And he said he was watching this guy who had done this thing a million times and was kind of dancing. He was sort of turning it into like a jog thing, you know? And it was like that moment of telling the story of how he got to work. And he said, okay, at the end, when he was finished telling the story, he said, notice how much more engaged you are than how you normally are if I just walk into the classroom and start talking about Chaucer or whatever. And I thought, I'd always had this lingering sense that I really wanted to be a writer and that I wanted to tell stories in some form or another. But during that class, for some reason, I thought, oh no, this is what I really want to do. And I was so overwhelmed by not knowing how one got to be a writer. I had no idea. You know, I'm 19 years old. It's completely overwhelming. Probably for a lot of people it is. How does one become a writer? There's no path. It's not like you can, it's not like going to law school and then you become a lawyer. It's like a very bumbling, stumbling route.
Yes. And it's so different for everyone. That's, I think, the scariest part is it really is. There's so many ways to become a writer. And then also, what is a writer? Like, what kind of writer do you want to become? And then, so how did you, what were those first steps? Like, how did you kind of fall into the rhythm?
Well, I had kind of been sort of chipping away at writing the whole time. I started writing poetry, I think, because it was very short, exceptionally bad poetry, I will add. And then I naturally gravitated towards prose and just started generating material. I didn't even really know what to call it. I suppose it was fiction. And I just sort of built this really voluminous stack of pages and didn't show anybody and didn't do anything to it. I think that's also very common. And then when when I left university and went to work, as a schlep planting trees in the real world, like we all do, with our day jobs, I decided at some point in my late 20s, I decided I wanted to go back to school and study writing. So I saved up my shekels and did an MFA AUBC, and that's where the rubber hit the pavement. That's where I got to understand, oh, this is how people do it. And mostly it was through meeting other writers and having a community, which is so important. I think that it's possible to be a writer on your own, but it is so much easier when you've got people around you. And that community looks like a million different things these days because, we have online, we have in person. Some of us live close to each other, some of us don't. I mean, probably any writer who's been around for a while has friends all over the country, if not the continent and the world.
Right. Yeah. I have to stop for a moment because I love what you just said about your MFA, because as someone who didn't do post-secondary education, I don't have an MFA. It is kind of for some of us, it's a little like thorn in our side. We always feel like maybe we have to prove ourselves and we deserve to be here because we don't have those things. And I think it's because obviously, an MFA is held in such high revere. It's really like, it's the golden ceiling, or the goal for a lot of writers. But what I love the way you described it was that it allowed you to create a community. You weren't talking about, the all the beautiful literature that you were working with or the mentors. It wasn't all this like fancy, smancy stuff that seems really unattainable. It really came down to community, and that whether you can afford to get an MFA, whether you have the opportunity, that is still something that's achievable for everyone to create a network and to create community. And did you find that, being able to have that community and presumably have them read some of your work, give them critiques, learn how to take critiques, was that really something important that you took away from that experience?
If I look at it retroactively, I think that's probably why I went to school to do a graduate degree in creative writing because, certainly not much of the writing that I actually did there has survived. And these days, I mean, this was in the days before, I graduated in 2000. So this was really in the days before it was possible to get an MFA online for free, which, by the way, I think is completely doable these days. So what I really wanted was a bunch of friends. I wanted a bunch of friends where we go to the bar and stay up really late and talking about writing. And that's kind of what happened. And I think that that is such a blessing and such a gift. I know that not everybody can do an MFA. I actually don't know that it's totally necessary. I don't know that I mean, I meet a lot of writers who never went to MFA programs and they have this ingenuity and style that took me, it took me many years to find my voice after I graduated from an MFA because I was trying to follow the rules.
Right. Yeah. But I still think it's important what you're talking about here with your experience is that so much of what you took away from it was just finding your community. It was finding your people because we do. It's, writing is so isolating and it's just us when we're working. So to be able to even just to use the program to be able to find a community that supports you and understands what you're going through when everybody else is just like, I don't understand why you can't just sit down and write from 9 to 5. Why doesn't that work? And your writer people are like, I get it, don't worry. So
Yeah,
that's
it's
really.
great to have people to talk to because you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what the sign over your door says, lonely writer. We work alone, and that process is by nature very solitary. And it's nice to have people that we can sit down and talk to and ask for advice. And without that, I think that It can still be done, but it's definitely more challenging. And, thank goodness it doesn't cost anything to make friends.
Exactly. It really doesn't. And I think, if anything, I think ultimately you end up benefiting from it. So, and that's coming from an introvert. So that's saying a lot. So let's talk about Almost Brown, because it's going to take me into my second question and the one we talk about the most about, our why of writing. So I'm going to grab my copy here and I'm going to read from the jacket description because it does a far better job at describing this beautiful book than I do. Charlotte Gill's father is Indian. Her mother is English. They meet in 1960s London when the world is not quite ready for interracial love. Their union results in a total meltdown of familial relations, a lot of immigration paperwork, and three children, all in varying shades of tan. Together, they set off on a journey to Canada and the United States in elusive pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, a dream that eventually tears them apart. Almost Brown is an exploration of diasporic intermingling involving two eccentric parents from worlds apart and their half-brown children as they experience the paradoxes and conundrums of life as it's lived between race checkboxes. Their intercultural experiment features turbans and tube socks, chana masala and cherry coke, feminist uprisings, racial alliances and divides, a divorce, multiple grudges, and plenty of bad fashion. The family implodes, but after 20 years of silence, father and daughter reclaim a space for forgiveness and love. Almost Brown is a funny, turbulent, and ultimately heartwarming book, but about the brilliant messiness of mixed race family and a search for answers to the question, what are you? Tender and incisive, it is both a deeply personal memoir and an excavation into ethnicity, ancestry, and race, a historical concept that still informs our beliefs about ethnicity today. This book was really, really touching for me. Not, I mean, it, clear as day, I'm very white, so that's not I've not struggled with race identity, but identity and how it relates to who I see my parents as, who they portray themselves as, and who they really are. And growing up, and that real like discovery of all the things that are untold, all the things that are assumed, and all the things that are real. And one of the things that really stuck with me the most was the question you ask, here on the jacket copy, what are you? And it stuck with me because not who are you, but what are you? And that for me was a concept that I didn't understand because I had never struggled with race identity. Who is very different than what? And so my question is, what was your why for writing this memoir? Did it start out as self-exploration and became something else, or was it a way to fill in the gaps for you and your family? Or kind of all of the above? What was the why for the impetus for this book?
Well, I'm a writer. I write fiction and nonfiction, and I think if you write in the first person memoir or, many of its hybrid varieties, I think the subject of childhood is always very tantalizingly lingering there. And this story for me was always there, but I was lacking the bravery to do it before because it's so personal. I mean, I'm writing about moments before I was born, how my parents got together, the circumstances that made that possible, and all the way up to, let's say the moment of publication. So it's a huge amount of personal material that is like, it's not the whole thing. Obviously, it's sorted and curated as we do when we write. But it was always kicking around in there, and I always knew I wanted to write it. But I needed some space and time from the intensity of that childhood experience. I don't think I could ever write a childhood memoir. I couldn't have done it when I was 25. Whereas I've written another memoir about tree planting, which was my job for, 2 decades. And that was much easier to write, but like right on the heels of the experience, because I was so the sensory aspects of the story are so important. Whereas in a childhood story, I think for many of us, we are stuck in the bubble of that lived experience for quite a while, and we don't see what is unusual or strange or eccentric about it until we're quite a distance away. And I needed that perspective in order to write from it, but also next to it, if that makes any sense at
It
all.
does.
So I tried a couple of times, and it just came out so earnest and plodding, and it lacked energy to me. And so each time I kept putting it away. And then I found this voice, which was funny. And that was something that took me a long time to get to. And the ability to make jokes about things that are heavy was, I really, it was a lot of trial and error. Emphasis on error in order to get there. But finally, I found this voice that I felt was going to work, that would allow me to capture everything in the story and be fair to everybody in the story.
I noticed that too. And it's a, so two things to talk about writing memoir, whether it be immediately after or something. It's funny because I think a lot of the time we think that distance from things creates more clarity. And when it comes to kid, like childhood, I believe that because we don't see things the same as a child. And when we're an adult, we have a lot more context and perspective. But when it comes to things that are happening as adults or even young adults, I think we have more clarity the closer we are to it. I think we start to misremember things as we get older and we, you know, life gets in the way of things and it takes on this weird, you know, kind of tilt to it that if we had just written it down at the time, it would felt so much more fresh. And that I think makes a huge difference when when we look at where we're writing from when it comes to memoir. But the other thing you mentioned is, yeah, your humor. And that was something that I really connected with when I was reading it because when I wrote my memoir, which was, you know, similarly, like we touched on dark things and like some subjects that maybe are really uncomfortable. And then I'd like throw in a joke about, you know, telling a detective that no, I didn't actually really want to talk to them. I kind of wanted to go home and crack a bottle of wine. Like, and I have readers tell me like that took them out of the seriousness of the moment, but not in a bad way. And that's what I found with yours. It was never a distraction from the intensity of what we were reading, so much as a light moment. It was like a breath. Because some of the things that I really loved in this book almost had me holding my breath. Like, especially some of the interactions between, you know, conversations with you and your father and things like that. You're almost kind of like holding your breath. And like, okay, how is this gonna wrap up? How are we, what's the outcome? And then to have moments of brevity, it allows the reader to ch kind of just breathe a little bit and then come back into the story. And so when you found your voice and you started to write this story, did you let anybody see it?
Okay, so I think that's a two-part question. So as a writer, I have writer friends who they're my beta readers, and I think many of us have beta readers. This book was sold on proposal, which is fairly typical for nonfiction. So then you have a fairly rapid deadline that comes up unless you've sort of generated the whole manuscript, and then you have, a year. So it was a small group of people who read the manuscript in draft form. Writer friends, they gave me lots of great advice on structure and things like that. And then when I got to the point of delivering the manuscript to the publisher, I sent it to my mother and my brother, who are most prominently featured in the story besides my dad. My dad, I kind of walked him through what I had written, but he's almost 90 and doesn't really read anymore, if that makes sense. So I knew that I offered it to him a couple of times, and he knows that I've written this book, and a lot of my family has now read this book. So, it's no secret, but I did give it to my mother and my brother to read it. And it was because when you tell people you're writing a memoir about family, I think there's a real terror that it's going to be exposing
Right.
and sensational. And I just wanted to assure them that this was not that.
In saying that, memoir is so vulnerable, and it is really takes a chunk out of you while writing, whether it's a happy story or we add humor to it. There is a lot of real muscle and tissue that goes into writing memoir, even more so to try to publish it. Because you're not just bleeding on the page, but now you're holding it up and saying, is this pretty enough to sell? You really have to really like flip from this, deep artist who's creating to a salesman. And so what was that process like for you? You sold it on proposal. I did myself as well. But what was it like to get someone to publish it? Because we're always being told that notoriously memoir is impossible to sell unless you have these massive platforms. And so what was that experience like for you to get it actually out the door and into a publisher's hands?
I'm gonna sort of answer this question. I'm gonna back right into this question. So the other day, an agent in Canada posted on Instagram, "Why is memoir so hard to publish?" And there was a lot of feedback as a result of that post. And she clarified the next day. And in many ways, I agree that memoir is really tough. I'm not part of the industry side of things, and I often hear from the industry side of things that memoir is very tough to publish. And yet I teach writing at the graduate level. I accompany writers as they're going through the process of writing memoir a lot. And actually a lot of them get published. And so, I mean, yes, I think that it's hard to have a book on the scale of, say, Cheryl Strayed's Wild. It's hard to have a blockbuster in memoir form, but these books are published a lot in Canada. And I think it's just a question of scale. If you would like a best-selling blockbuster, I think there are no guarantees for any of us, but I think people really connect with first-person stories. They really connect with memoir. There's so much out there in the world right now that is staged and fake and curated. I think people are so hungry for stories that feel real, that are real. And anybody can tell the difference. I think you could give a 6-year-old a memoir and say, "Is this real?" And they would be able to tell you, because we must have some kind of innate human ability to know what emotion and real life looks like.
That's really inspiring. I'm glad that you said that. I try to echo that same kind of statement to people, and it comes back to our why of writing. If you want to write a bestseller that gets, film adaptations and all this kind of stuff, good luck. I really genuinely like, yes, Cheryl Strayed is a fantastic writer, but I genuinely feel like it is it's a shooting star moment. It is so subjective who hits those bestseller lists when it comes to memoirs and things like that. But if it's really just about you telling your story, and whether you're doing it for yourself or for your family or for your community, that can be done in so many ways and so many avenues. So I'm happy that you're talking about that, because I think the more we tell people it can be done, the more of us who are going to feel like it's worth putting all of that time and energy and labor into, and that it'll find the right person, it'll find the right agent, it'll find the right publisher. And I do genuinely feel like the world is a better place with more of us telling authentic stories. I don't know if you experienced this when you were a kid, but I know coming from the East Coast of Canada, storytelling was just such a thing. That was like ingrained in, I hate to say culture because I'm white and we don't have culture, but the culture of families and generations, and especially the women in our families. And I think a lot of us have felt really divided and isolated in the last 5, 6 years. And I think this kind of bringing back this kind of storytelling of families and cultures and experiences is what we need right now. And it's powerful.
I think that that's a really good question, actually. As a mixed race person, I'm not sure what my cultural storytelling looks like because it is such a melange of things. I felt as if there are, I knew that there were thousands, if not millions, of people out there who come from mixed ancestry who also feel as if there's really no baseline from which to tell a story because you are borrowing a little bit from both sides. And, I know this because I'm part of a lot of these online communities that mixed race people belong to, and we all say the same things. Just my reason why I write in the first person, why I write nonfiction as well as fiction, is because oftentimes I don't know what I think about something until I write it down.
Right.
So writing for me is like a process of understanding the world and knowing what I think about something. And then after I have written it, it feels as if there's a form of closure. And now I can put that thing that was like maybe low level tormenting me for a long time. I can kind of fold that thing up and put it away, maybe not totally, but most.
In a slightly more satisfactory closure type way, because I don't think closure is a thing, to be honest. I think it's something that we're told is out there so that we feel like, well, we'll keep going until we get some closure. But I don't think that's a thing. And I think, honestly, I think it's one of the things I kind of love about memoir, because it's not an autobiography. We're not telling a whole person's story. We're telling a snippet. We're just viewing into this moment in their life. And it may not have a clear beginning and it may not have a clear ending, but that's okay, because we're still finding so much within that story. And in Almost Brown, I really felt that there was still there's still is so much to come from your story and from your family's story, and so much more, I think, that you could discover. And I think a lot that it will inspire your readers to discover in their own family. And I think that's really fantastic. So final question I'm gonna give you is the one that everybody hates. What are you working on next? And as I'm
Oh,
starting,
that's easy.
okay, well, just as I'm starting to say now, if you're taking a break, that's totally valid. But if you're working on something, we'd love to know.
yes, I'm working on fiction again.
Yay.
I know it doesn't really show in this book, but there was a ton of research that went into Almost Brown. And I did most of that during the pandemic in a super inefficient way because, of course, it was very hard to actually get anything.
Right.
Like libraries were closed, and even it was hard to get digitized things for a long time. So I felt exhausted by filter feeding all this material just to boil it down into something that was readable and fun. So I didn't want to do anything with research, although I know that research is part of fiction. So I'm working on fiction right now. I will say that I am one of these writers who is writing all the time. I am generating massive amounts of material behind the scenes. Some of it, obviously doesn't always show up in public. But to me, it feels like writing is the structure of my life. I get up in the morning, I drink a coffee, and I write something. And if I don't do that for several days in a row, I don't feel very good. And I think that's also a very common thing in writers' lives. So, yeah, it's the thing that structures my day, really. I'm always working on
I
something.
think it's a bit like a flexing a muscle, right? Like, I mean, I think if we genuinely don't do something for a period of time, then when you come back to it, yeah, you feel stiff. You feel like, so, I've heard that before. I think, like, don't worry about word counts or pages, or just write every single day. Just come to your work every single day, and it keeps those, those muscles all nice and jacked up for your next project.
Yeah, well, I'm a runner and I know you are too, Eden. And it feels very similar to that. I
It
mean,
does.
I wouldn't consider myself to be like a super athletic person, but I run to kind of express, to vent steam or to
Yes.
express energy that would otherwise be would be too bottled up. And writing and running feel very similar in that way. Like obviously I'm not training to be on an Olympic team, but it's just sort of like
It's just,
psychic maintenance
yeah,
somehow.
for me, it's like I explained to my kids, like when you see a dog that gets really worked up about something, usually it's like a squirrel in the front yard, right? And then you, oh, you calm down, calm down, calm down. And they shake their bodies. And it is this theory that essentially we're shaking energy out of us. And so for me, that's what running and writing and dancing and like a lot of things like that is. Sometimes it's just, I feel all coiled up inside. I've got this energy and I've got all this creativity and all this kind of stuff. And sometimes you just have to like shake it out, like physically move it out of your body. And yeah, running can do that. Taking a walk before you sit down to write can do that. Putting on some 80s dance music and just like blasting it out in your living room can do it. So, but I agree, like we have to flex that muscle every single day and really put in the time and dedication, and I think the work will thank you for it in the end when it's time to put a book on the shelves. So thank you so much for chatting with me today. I want everyone to get out to their local independent booksellers and pick up a copy of Almost Brown if they haven't. But let our listeners know where they can find you online to stay up to date on everything Almost Brown and everything that's coming after that. Where can we find you?
I am at charlottegill.com. That's my website. I'm also on Instagram a lot these days, and there you can find me at It's the Char. Twitter, not so much for I think obvious
Yeah.
reasons. But yeah, if anybody wants to say hello or see what I'm up to, Instagram's a great place. I'm gonna be at some writers' festivals this fall. If you're in the western part of the country, it'll be great to see and meet you.
Fantastic. That's exciting. Oh, just the idea of us being able to go to a real human place and meet each other. That is super exciting. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite show. Thank you again, and until next time, Lonely Writers, be well.